All right, we've got that down, right? So they will know that I'm the Lord. All right, so by way of review, we remember that Ezekiel has the vision at the beginning of the book. He sees God's throne that is depicted more of as a chariot, a mobile war chariot, as you may want to call it. And Ezekiel is assigned the role of a watchman, which, as we've been asking, what is the role of a watchman? To warn. We're not defending, we're not fighting, we're warning. Okay? All right? And then we see just a whole series of different things that Ezekiel does. He has to act out certain things. The first one being he acts out the siege of Jerusalem. He builds a little model. He lays down beside it for 430 days. And so he's showing that Jerusalem will be under siege. And then we have all kind of different illustrations of what is to happen. God also takes the time to go into why these things are happening. Remember, Ezekiel has shown Jerusalem as it is at that moment, all the vile things that are happening in Jerusalem, the hideous different things, and the direct slaps in God's face that is happening. And so it's showing why Jerusalem must fall. And then we went into several parables and prophecies depicting these things. And, you know, there's a lot of concentration on the actual rulers and the leaders as well, how they have mishandled things, how they've led the people down their own path. But all along the way, we're getting these little nuggets of hope. We just get kind of these little things that God's letting them know, okay, we're going to bring them back. I brought you out, but I'm going to bring you back. And then as we left things last week, Ezekiel gets word that Jerusalem has gone under siege. Nebuchadnezzar has put them under siege, which is at 588 B.C. Pretty sure that's very early in the year, possibly even January-ish by our calendar of 588. And so that's where we've left. Also, at the very end, what happens to Ezekiel? He loses his wife, and of course it's in our questions, but what is he not allowed to do? He is not allowed to mourn his wife. And so, and we talked about that briefly, about how that is the way they are to be. It's a symbol of them losing Jerusalem and how they are not to mourn Jerusalem, because this is God's justice. This is this was the way it should have been. Okay, all right. So now let's look at our questions. I got it mislabeled. It should be from lesson 8, but the questions are correct. So we'll run through those right quick. I was told Miss Luella is where we left. Do you concur with Teresa? All right, it's unanimous then. So I guess we're to start with Keith. Okay, I've got it more listed at 590, but what was the date that he, how does he express it? There you go, and that is from what point? Jehoiachin, yeah, y'all keep me straight on my chins and Kims. But yeah, from the captivity of Jehoiachin going to Babylonia. All right, number two, Wes. Okay, all right, anybody on that row? I know y'all hadn't been in here, so I guess we're up to Dad. Okay, so the nation of Israel, he made known himself in Egypt. All right, number three. Right. All right. And we talked about that a good bit last week. Sandy? Okay. Stanley? Four. Correct. Number five, Miss Cindy. Okay. All right, so who is the sword? All right, so in this case, Nebuchadnezzar at this time, right? All right, number six, Vicky.
What nation is God under his name?
The Ammonites, right? Yeah. And we'll get to talk to them a little more today. All right, number seven. All right, what's right there at the end of verse 12? They forgot God. That's what led to everything else. So that's why I asked it that way, is what was the root of the sins? All right, number eight. Right, a lying that is destroying and tearing. All right, number nine. Was that Miss Edna? Okay. Teresa? Miss Marie? Correct. All right, number 10. Right. I've got 588, but it, you know, it's right there close, because we're right at the beginning of 588 if it is. Okay, all right, coming back around, Mr. Brady, number 11.
What happens in 24:18? What was Ezekiel not allowed to do? Wife died, he was not born.
Okay, that's right. He loses his wife, and that is representative of God losing his people, as well as, you know, or the phrase left me, but... the desire of his eyes, and then they're not allowed to mourn because this was a just judgment on them. Okay, all right, so now getting into our lesson for today, that brings us up to chapter 25. Again, we'll make the attempt to make it through chapter 32, and we'll see what happens. All right, so just taking a look at our map here, I hope you can see that. So we've left Jerusalem under siege. Ezekiel has been widowed. He's not allowed to mourn her. We're just talking about that. And the captives, they're supposed to follow suit. They're not to mourn Jerusalem, the loss of Jerusalem. Of course, it's not completely gone yet, but it's under siege. So it's not looking good. And so we're going to kind of take a little bit of a shift, and God's going to make sure his people understand that he's not picking on them. He's got other business to tend to, too. It's not, he's not just judging Israel. There's others that's going to have to answer for what they've done as well. And so as you kind of look at your surrounding nations, God kind of starts pronouncing judgment on each one. And if you kind of notice, he goes in kind of a clockwise way, which is the right way to answer questions in clockwise manner. But anyways, now excluding Egypt. Egypt's kind of a special case. But otherwise, we'll see that we go over to Ammon. We'll go down through Moab, come up through Edom, come up through Phoenicia, you know, and all. So you're kind of getting a circular pattern there of going around the nations that's surrounding Jerusalem and Judah. All right, so... All right, so we've talked about Jonah a few times, right? Going to a foreign nation. So what was the purpose of Jonah going to Nineveh? Yeah, to warn them. And so what was the hope, what was God hoping would result from him going to Nineveh? Repentance, right? Did it work? It did, at least temporarily, right? So is that the purpose of these prophecies? Yeah, negatory. Ezekiel's in Babylon. And God didn't tell him to pack his bags and go to these places, did he? He's just pronouncing judgment on these surrounding nations and cities. And so why then are these being pronounced if he's not trying to call about repentance? Okay, all right. So we know that he's God and he's bringing judgments. All right, so we're showing the justice of God, right? God's not just picking on Israel. If you've done wrong, you're going to, the price is going to have to be paid somehow, right? So what else might you think? We're seeing the justice of God. What else might we find out? Okay, so what shall they know? That I am the Lord. All right, and then the only other thing I've kind of got is kind of the similar message that we're seeing in Daniel. What do we kind of say is the message of Daniel? God rules in the kingdoms of men. So I think those are kind of the message. I think those are kind of the themes that are the ideas that's trying to be portrayed here. I mean, the whole book of Ezekiel, I mean, the judgment's set. There's no, I'm not saying there's no point in repentance, but repentance is not going to make a difference, right? And that's the same case with these surrounding nations. It's done. I mean, now, as we've mentioned, we're not talking about it on an individual basis. Individuals can make change and make a difference for themselves. But as far as a nation goes, these judgments are set. There's no changing them at this point. We're past the point of no return. And so, you know, I think we can kind of look at that as a warning to ourselves, right? As a nation, as a church, as a family. You know, you can push yourself to the point to where you can't get out of the consequences. And so we need to keep that in mind as we go.
Well, also, I think it's pretty obvious at this point that they're not going to
repent. Yeah, and I think that's the point that God sees, that he's able to see. And so he knows they're not going to, and so the judgment's set. It's time to go. So, any thoughts on that before we kind of go into the individual prophecies here? All right, so let's go into chapter 25. You'll kind of see a pattern on a lot of these. They don't all fit exact, but you'll see God providing an offense that this nation has done, and then, of course, pronounce the judgment. Some of them are kind of similar to each other, but there's usually something kind of unique to each one. So first, we start with Ammon. Now, where did the nation of Ammon, where did it come from? Say it again. Lot, right? This was a nation from Lot. There were two nations from Lot. We'll get the other one in a second. But this is one that came from Lot. All right? So what Ammon did, you know, Lot was a pretty good guy, right? But his descending nation, they didn't care a whole lot for Israel. Actually, pretty much nobody cared much for Israel, with a few exceptions. What they're accused of here is they took pleasure in the troubles of God's people. It says, you know, as they started to experience the downfall, you know, Ammon's sitting there saying, aha, they're getting it. They're getting what they deserve. And so they were taking pleasure in that and were enjoying the fact that Jerusalem and Israel, as well as Judah, were all suffering and having these bad things. And so so God tells them that you will be delivered to the men of the east. Now, who is that? Very obviously. Sorry? Babylon. Yes, Babylon. And then right now, Nebuchadnezzar, right? And so they're going to be falling to the people of the east. Rabbah's mentioned by name, the city there, a good bit. You know, that city is somewhat still around, right, Leon? At least there's a place.
Today it's called the Monument, the capital
yeah.
Jordan.
Yeah, yeah, it's a part of Jordan. But what you see is that territory there is never again, once Nebuchadnezzar gets there, he's not there yet. But once he gets, you know, they're never really a full independent city-state anymore. They're going to be part of something else from there on out. And so their power, their influence is not going to be there. And of course, as is our refrain, what will they know? Okay, all right. So now we move on to Moab. Where did Moab come from? Lot as well, the other nation. Remember, Lot had the two daughters, and then that's where these two nations sprang from. And so now we have Moab, and I think I got a slide for them. Yeah. So what their offense was is that they did not recognize Israel as God's special people. They saw them as just like every other nation, didn't recognize their specialness to God. And so because of that, it says that their territory is going to be cleared and again given to the men of the east. And so there again, it's kind of a similar situation as we had with Ammon. I think I may have put my notes in the wrong spot, but we know that Josephus gives us a reference that that Nebuchadnezzar did come against Ammon. You know, I know Ammon was what we was talking about a second ago, but Nebuchadnezzar did come against them around 581. As like I said, that's according to Josephus. And also we have reference to that in detail in Jeremiah chapter 48, if you wanted to reference that and look up some information on that. Did I get anything mixed up with that, Leon, that you know of? Yeah.
No, I'm not recalling that.
Okay. All right. I looked that up, so I'm hoping I'm telling you that right. But whatever the case, this judgment is pronounced, and we do know that their influence and their power is taken out. Next in chapter 25, we have Edom mentioned. Where does Edom come from? That's Esau's descendants. And so it mentions the fact that they took their own vengeance on Judah whenever they felt they were done wrong. They were the ones that executed their own judgment. They didn't consult God. They didn't let God take his vengeance. They did it themselves. What was kind of the... Y'all remember any instances of the relationship between Edom and Israel? Maybe really early on? Yes. As Moses and the people were coming from the land of Egypt, they very beyond politely asked, can we pass through your land? And Edom, beyond non-politeness, said no. And so that was not a good start to a relationship between these two nations once Israel was coming back. And so there's just a history of bitterness happening there. And that, by the way, that story takes place in Numbers chapter 20. But it says, because of this, God will reach out, and both man and beast will be cut off in the land. It'll be desolate, and so it's not going to be a happy place when God gets finished with it. All right, and then I think last in chapter 25, we have our old buddy Philistia. Now, I was thinking about this. You remember how even in the old Batman series, you kind of had the same enemies coming up over and over. You had the Penguin and the Riddler and all these guys. Well, Philistia would be the Joker, all right? They're the ones that just kept showing up, kept putting the thorn in the side and laughing all the way. And so Philistia, it says that they acted vengefully because of the old hatred. I just found that it's interesting language because we know definitely through the judges, through Saul and David, they always had trouble with them. Of course, we know Solomon didn't for obvious reasons. You know, his reign was different. But the Philistines just kept coming back, kept being a thorn in the side. They never could quite get them out of their way. So, y'all remember where Philistia was? That's right, along the seacoast. So what was important to them? Right, trade, fishing, whatever, the things that went along with the sea, right? And so what does God say he's going to strike? The seashore. And so he kind of hits them at the heart there, and that's how he says he will bring about judgment to them. All right, so that brings us to the end of chapter 25. By the way, what will they know? Okay. All right, chapter 26. Make sure everybody good on 25, right? All right, so 26, we now look to Tyre. Now, what is Tyre? And not the rubber thing on your vehicle. Tyre, I'm sorry. So we talked about, these were nations that we were talking about, and then we're talking about Tyre. What was Tyre? Yeah, it's a city. It was up on the northwestern coast from Israel, right? And it was a very influential city, and so we actually spend a lot of time, God spends a lot of time talking about the judgment on Tyre. And so it's just kind of interesting. Yeah, yeah, anything Phoenician would have come from that area. Yes, yeah, yes, Phoenician city. But so the problem with Tyre is that it claims that now that Jerusalem is going under, they're going to benefit from it. They're going to get all the stuff, because remember, all the trade routes came right down through Jerusalem, the land trade routes, you know, and so Tyre was all about the sea trade. They're thinking now, hey, we're going to become a center for the land route too. We're going to benefit from this. We're going to get all this stuff. And so they feel like they're going to benefit from the fall. And so they're just licking their chops, waiting for this to happen. And of course, that is not the way God wants people treating his people. And so he will take vengeance upon that. It mentions that God will have many to come against them in waves. And I'm sorry, but I've got to share this with you. I feel like it's just an interesting piece of history. But so Nebuchadnezzar does go against Tyre. But the thing was, is there were two pieces to Tyre. You had the mainland Tyre, and then you had a Tyre out on the island. So you had the old Tyre and the new Tyre. And I'm sorry, me and Dad were at College Tyre yesterday, and I seen a bunch of new tires and a bunch of old tires, and it's messing up my head. But you had old Tyre that was on the mainland, new Tyre that was on the island, and Nebuchadnezzar came up, took out old Tyre, no problem. But that was pretty much a fortress sitting out there on that island. And so he had a lot of struggle against that. And long story short, he sat there for 13 years trying to get it. Didn't have any luck. And that will be of interest when we get a little further down the road here in today's lesson. But anyway, but that was not successful. But remember, God says that they will come against you like the waves of the seashore. Well, it takes a little time, but 150 years roughly later, we've got Alexander the Great coming. Alexander the Great, he's like, we ain't going to do this. So he destroys the city, takes the rubble, builds a causeway out to the island. And, of course, it's still not an easy task, but he is able to eventually take new Tyre as well. So, and then just completely off to the side, that causeway ended up changing like the flow of the currents and all this kind of stuff. And now that's really nice and wide, and there's buildings and streets and everything going out to that. It's just almost a piece of the main land again. But anyway, I digress a little bit. So in verse 14, it mentions the fact that it's going to be like the top of a rock. So in other words, Tyre's going to be scraped clean like the top of a rock. And so that does eventually end up kind of being the case. And of course, I think we're referring to old Tyre. You know, it goes from being this mighty, mighty city that we'll talk about more in the following chapters to basically a fishing village where people would come clean their nets. And so it's going to be a mighty fall when it falls. And of course, old Tyre is pretty much like at least the point of my research. There may be some since then, but they almost can't even hardly tell where it was. It's so gone. Now, new Tyre, that's a whole different story. They know that. And it's thriving at this moment. But old Tyre is pretty much gone. So that kind of brings us to chapter 27. We're still talking about Tyre. There's a big, long lament that is spelled out for Tyre. It talks about the fact that Tyre is compared to a fine ship. It's got all the riches, all the nice things from all over, the finest riches, the greatest, the best material that could be made, that could be, if it was the best that could go on a ship, it was in this figurative ship that is described as Tyre. And so It's also adorned with, or manned with the best crew that could be assembled. So this this Tyre is really given a lot of respect as to the point of what kind of city it has become. And of course, a ship is the fitting symbol, right? Because this is a shipping capital of the Mediterranean. And so so that's what's brought about. It mentions, you know, the different places. Tarshish, y'all remember where Tarshish was? Spain. Yeah, so Spain, that's pretty far in ancient world terms, right? So, I mean, that's the other end of the Mediterranean. Okay, all right. Yeah, I didn't look that up, but that sounds reasonable. So Bill's saying he thinks about 2,500 miles. Remember, that's how far Jonah was trying to get, right? But anyway, so yeah, so we're talking about Tarshish in Spain. We've got Javan mentioned, which would be somewhere around Greece. Various tribes of Asia Minor. The island of Rhodes. That was a pretty interesting little place. And it mentions many more, but all of these were just at the admirers of Tyre, you know, the customers, the people that would often had all the trade that went through that city. And so I want to look at verse 25, which kind of basically gives us a nice little summary of what it was. So in chapter 27, verse 25, it says, "The ships of Tarshish were carriers of your merchandise. You were filled and very glorious in the midst of the seas." So that kind of wraps it up in one simple sentence. You know, just anybody that had anything to do with sea trade knew about Tyre. And so it was a mighty, mighty city. But then what this chapter goes on to say is basically this fine ship, it got overloaded. And so it finally begins to sink. And so I think that's obvious what it's representing. You know, they kind of got full of themselves. They started relying on what they could do themselves instead of giving homage and recognizing God for who he was and his role in things. And so the ship gets overloaded. It begins to sink. It goes at length about all these admirers we've been talking about, the mourning that they will have, the sorrow that they see in losing such a city. Such a partner in their trade. But not only will they mourn, did anybody happen to notice what other emotion would be involved?
That the merchants would hiss at them.
Okay, yeah, so there'd be some hatred, anger there, but there's another one I'm kind of looking for. And I didn't mark a good verse. But if you see one of your peers that's mighty like that fall, what emotion might hit you? No, well, I mean, you might, but that's not what happens here. How about fear? That the same thing may happen to you. They fear. They see what happens to them. And so he's saying, you know, when they see this, maybe they will see something. They will change, or maybe they'll understand. And see the difference. So they will mourn, they'll be sad, but also they're going to tremble. They're going to be afraid and hopefully recognize God for what his part is in things.
Verse 35 and 36,
okay, thank you. Yes. All the inhabitants of the isles will be astonished at you, their kings will be greatly afraid, and their countenance will be troubled. The merchants among you will hiss, as Russell mentioned, and you will become a horror and will know and be no more feared. So that will be what that will be the result. They will see, they will fear this calamity upon them as a possibility. All right. Let's look at chapter 28. We might make it if we hurry. All right. So now, chapter 28, we're still talking about Tyre. But this time we focus on the prince of Tyre, or the king. I still always find it interesting every time I see that term prince, as we talked about a week or two ago. So we're talking about the prince of Tyre, and he has gone so far as to elevate himself as a god. We get a nice little mention of Daniel again here. He says he even thinks he's wiser than Daniel. And I am pretty confident that this is our Daniel that we're talking about again. Because by this time, Daniel probably has a pretty good name in history. He's been around a while. And his influence was pretty great pretty early. So he thinks he's wiser than Daniel. So that, again, gives you that regard that not only Ezekiel has for Daniel, but here this is God speaking. God, the regard God has for Daniel. You think you're that wise. And so so there we have that reference again. This prince sees that he's rich. He thinks he's wise. But God says he will tear him down and throw him in the pit. And we're going to see here from this pit continually as we go through this. So we kind of get down to verse 11 through 19, kind of describes this fall. There's some confusion. Some people see this as the fall of Satan. Kind of like the UFOs in the first chapter, they pull some interesting things from different stuff. The context don't seem to support that. We do kind of see a comparison to the fall of Adam as Eden gets mentioned here. In other words, this prince had everything at his disposal. Everything was good. Everything was perfect. Everything was the way he would have liked it. But he doesn't give God the due respect, and all that gets thrown away and thrown into the pit. And then just kind of in passing, Sidon. Normally, every time we'd mention Tyre, you'd get Sidon thrown in, Tyre and Sidon, right? Almost like Sodom and Gomorrah. They just kind of thrown it in, Sidon gets thrown into the mix of this judgment. I did want to look at verse 24 of 27, I'm sorry, of 28. It says, and there shall, we've kind of reached the end of this particular list. We're about to get into Egypt, and that's going to be an extensive one. But we're kind of at the end of this I would say, relatively minor list. Now, as we've kind of concluded that thought, verse 24 brings up, he says, and there shall no longer be a pricking briar or a painful thorn for the house of Israel from among all who are around them, who despise them. Then they shall know that I am the Lord. So it's kind of that complete concluding statement about these nations. You know, these were all exactly the way it said, thorns, prickling things, annoyances to Israel. And they were always against Israel, always set themselves against Israel and Judah. And so God says, that wasn't my bell, right? and so that thorn's being taken away. And we'll mention that thought again here in a little bit too. Any thoughts on that before we dive on into Egypt's judgment?
Well, Solomon had met a treaty, I think, with Tyre, hadn't he?
Yeah.
But that treaty is long gone.
Right. Yeah. Hiram was about probably the bright point in their history as far as the relationship with Israel. We're long past that. I think so. So let's take a look at Egypt. Egypt, there's a reason why biblical scholars go to Egypt a lot, isn't there, Leon? Egypt is a constant in the history of God's people. And so it's a very influential nation. It's not always a good one. But Egypt, you would never use the word humble when describing Egypt, would you? They've always been a very proud nation, and they've always been a very successful nation as far as the world would go. They've always have been very rich. They've always been very organized, very advanced in everything they've ever done. But their proximity to Israel just makes them an integral part of Israel's history. And so that's going to be addressed here, starting in verse 29, in chapter 29. So we kind of start out in a kind of a poetic fashion with Egypt. Egypt is compared to a mighty sea monster, or at least an aquatic monster. And, you know, my guess, I'm kind of picturing a crocodile, a big, mighty crocodile. You know, it's very common along the Nile. And so it'd be very reasonable that that might be something you'd see or might be envisioned here. But it says that this sea monster gets caught on the hook, it's hooked, and just left out to become food for the beasts of the land. And so, you know, you think of this mighty, you know, something as mighty as a crocodile or something like that, you know, just being caught, drug out, and left. It's a very humbling experience for a creature such as that. But let's take a look at verses 6 and 7 of chapter 29. It says, "Then all the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am the Lord, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel." Okay, I think about that reed for a second. All right, verse 7. "When they took hold of you with the hand, you broke and tore all their shoulders. When they leaned on you, you broke and made all their backs quiver." So when you think about a reed, would that make a good walking stick or weapon or anything like that? No, it's paper thin, it's flexible, it's brittle, it breaks easily. And so it's just kind of interesting when you look back at the history and the relationship between God's people and Egypt. It's like Israel just time and again reaches out to Egypt for help, and it looks like it's going to work, but the hand ends up getting bit just almost every time. And so, I mean, even going back to the time when Joseph goes to Egypt, and although Egypt would never admit it, Joseph saved their country. And then we get down the line just a little bit, and they enslave his relative. They enslave his family. They enslave the people. And then, you know, there's been various times when Israel would look to try to make an alliance with Egypt and try to get things going. That would almost invariably fall through. Something would happen, and that wouldn't be. So it's like they have been a very unreliable ally. And even very recently at this point in time, remember all the going back and forth between Assyria and Egypt and then Babylon and Egypt, and Israel just kept ended up being a pawn, and they would swap allegiances and all this type of thing. And Israel always ended up getting the raw end of the deal every time that happened. And so that relationship has always been strained. And so, and of course, their arrogance that we've read about time and time again. God has decided Egypt is going to receive judgment as well. And so it says that God will lay them waste for 40 years. We don't know exactly what that is. There is some evidence that leads us to think that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, he invaded in 568, and there was some scattering. We don't know many details, but we, at this point, in the lack of evidence, we put our trust in God, that we know that he knew what he was talking about when he was making this prophecy. And there may be some more there that I just haven't been able to find, but I'm confident that this was part of it. But what we do know is that once Nebuchadnezzar comes in and breaks things, Egypt's never what it was ever again. Egypt was always independent. Egypt was always powerful. Egypt was always rich. But once this happens, things kind of go down. And they're still always, I mean, Egypt's always important. I mean, they're still important. But throughout history, Egypt remains important, but they're not the ones in control of themselves. Because you have, you know, first Nebuchadnezzar comes through. We know Alexander the Great. He's then in control of Egypt. Sets the Ptolemies up, that Ptolemy dynasty, I guess is the only way to say it. And so you have all that going until finally Rome comes through, and in Egypt's just a pawn in the history of Rome, and just, or almost like a football being kicked back and forth among the different powers of Roman history. And so Egypt is now subject. They're not the one in control. They no longer had that power. But let's look at verse 16. "No longer shall it be the confidence of the house of Israel." Remember, Israel would always reach out to Egypt when it felt like it was in trouble. "It will no longer be the confidence of the house of Egypt, or of Israel, but will remind them of their iniquity when they turn to follow them. Then they shall know that I am the Lord." And so we can see why God is upset with Egypt and is wanting them taken care of. Now around verse 17, it mentions the fact that, you know, remember we talked about when Nebuchadnezzar went, he wasn't overly successful with, again, when he went against Tyre. But in verse 17, it lets him know, hey, since Tyre didn't work out for you, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, you're my buddy or my servant, my, you know, you're my weapon of wrath, and I'm going to reward you for that. So since Tyre didn't really work out for you, I'm going to give you the riches of Egypt. I'm going to give you the plunder of Egypt. And so I thought that was very interesting, and that, you know, that does come about. All right, so real quick, let's look at chapter 30. So chapter 30, it mentions the allies of Egypt. They're going to suffer the same fate. In verse 5, it says, Ethiopia, Libya, Lydia, all the mingled peoples, Chub, and the men of the lands who were allied shall fall with them by the sword. So they're going to be thrown in that pit right there with Egypt. And what happens in verse 19? Or what will they understand? They shall know that I am the Lord. Getting down to verse 20, it says that Pharaoh's arm is broken. He will not wield that power. And that's kind of what we were talking about a while ago. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is no longer going to have the influence that it once had and wield the power that it always has had. All right, chapter 31, Egypt gets compared to a tree. That seems to be a common metaphor that's used. It gets compared to this mighty tree. You know, everybody benefited from it. It influenced everybody in some way. But that tree is to be felled, and everybody's going to leave from out from under it. And when it falls, it's going to be heard and feared by the nation. Yet again, that influence is going to be there. They're going to see that when you cross God's people, it's going to be a resounding fall. Then in chapter 32. Again, Egypt is mentioned as is brought up as being that sea beast. This time it's caught and slaughtered. And of course, this will make the nations fear God whenever he brandishes his sword, is some of the language that's used in that one. And yet again, it says Egypt will be thrown into the pit with all these other nations that we've been talking about. So I think we made it. I don't know that I did anything any justice, but we made it. Next week, I think we can kind of take a little bit of a breath. We're going to cover about 3 chapters, if all goes well, next week. And then we'll see how we go from there.